works out. Now, first of all, is Mr. Bellamy there? Ah. Now, first of all, partly to clarify what I said last time, I would like to answer a criticism of Mr. Bellamy, which was made after the lecture, which I think is quite relevant. Now, let us, last time, if you remember, I criticized Popper's demarcation criteria. And I used an example, namely, in fact, I think I took the liberty to use it twice. You remember that imaginary Newtonian scientists who predict that here is the sun and here is the Earth somewhere outside the orbit of this planet, and he predicts this orbit, he observes this orbit, then he predicts the existence of a disturbing planet, which he doesn't find, then he predicts the existence of a cosmic dust which hides it, he doesn't find it, he invents a magnetic field and so on. Now Bellamy pointed out that this procedure is an argument for Popper, not against. Why? Because according to Popper, we first is a Newtonian puts forward a completely falsifiable conjecture that the planets moves in this way. Now this is falsifiable, a potential falsifier can be specified with, namely, that at a predicted time the planet will be somewhere else, for instance here. Now, this is, so this is a falsifiable and also incidentally consistent conjecture. Nothing is wrong with this step. Now, the conjecture is refuted. After conjecture comes the refutation. Everything is all right. Now, then, the Newtonian scientist abandons this conjecture and puts forward another one, namely that there is here a disturbing planet which we haven't discovered yet. Now this is non-ad hoc in the sense that after all it increases the content of the theory, it predicts now, it is, we have now a new theory. Namely, that we have, of course, also Newtonian laws with the conjunction of the initial conditions, but now we replace this with a different set of initial conditions in which this new planet figures. A non-ad hoc maneuver, completely permissible, in Popper's sense. Nothing wrong. Now, we try to look at it through a telescope, we don't find it. The new conjecture is followed by a new refutation, conjectures and refutations. Now, we then put forward a new conjecture, now the third conjecture, about this cosmic dust. Again, it is non-ad hoc because it is testable after all. We can send up a satellite and test it. Well, we don't find it, refutation, what is wrong? Then we abandon our whole conjunction of elaborate hypotheses and we replace it by another one which contains this magnetic field, which again is independently testable in Popper's sense, non ad hoc. What is wrong with it? So this whole procedure which I produced, in fact, can be shown as a paradigm example of a Popperian rational behavior on the part of the Newtonian scientist. Now, I do give that much credit to my friend Bellamy that I certainly couldn't have made the point clear or sufficiently clear that this is a deadly counter-Popperian example in spite of what I have said. So let us go now into a little bit of more detail. Now, first of all, and this is now a, how should I put it, exegetic red herring, but I just want to make it, that what I now describe is Popper 1935 in his Logical Scientific Discovery. Now in 1960, which appears actually later in his Conjectures and Refutations in 1960, I don't know, 2 or 3, he said that we need an additional requirement, namely, a conjecture really can be saved if it is non ad hoc in two senses. So that means that we have to abandon it if at least one of its empirical consequences is not confirmed. Now, this criterion is, frankly, I don't want to go into details. This goes, it comes from a completely different confusion in Popper's philosophy, which I don't want to discuss in this course. But on this criterion, certainly this falls down. But frankly, this I only want to put it in a pedantic way and come back to 1935. Now, there are Popper in his demarcation criteria is systematically ambiguous, and for good reason. Namely, he says, and you can look it up in Conjectures and Refutations, page 30, in a long footnote, he says, I am asking the Marxist or the psychoanalyst, he should specify a potential falsifier, not just to a specific version of his theory, but to the hard core of it. Well, this is my expression. He says, I don't remember why, he's the main axioms of it. That means, you see, this is Popper's, how should I put it, moral requirement. You see, I mentioned to you earlier that most criteria of demarcation contain a sort of code of intellectual honesty. If you have, if you put forward a conjecture, you have to specify a potential falsifier. If it is falsified, you are morally bound to abandon it and publicly confess that your assumption was false. And the hard core of it, you can't fiddle with this initial condition. Pardon? Sorry? Page 30, Conjectures and Refutations. We don't have it.
I don't say it's not.
Oh.
I think you are the last
chair. Actually, I think the only difference is that this is the most recent. It is on page 38. I read it out. You see, this is a new edition with new preface, so the page is shifted. I read it out. Real support can be obtained only from observations undertaken as tests by attempted refutations. And for this purpose, criteria of refutation have to be laid down beforehand. It must be agreed which observational situations, if actually observed, means that the theory is refuted. But what kind of clinical responses would refute to the satisfaction of the analyst? And now listen, not merely a particular analytic diagnosis, but psychoanalysis itself. Have such criteria ever been discussed or agreed by analysts? Now that is one of the many quotations to this effect. So that means now translated to Marxism, under the Marxist is morally bound to specify an event which if it takes place, he has to abandon not just a particular analysis, that means initial conditions and specific variant, but Marxism itself. Now, how on earth can we interpret Marxism if it is only a sort of specific version with 25 initial conditions and auxiliary hypotheses? Can never be then refuted. And incidentally, now if we take the weaker version of Popper's theory, namely, but actually, you can, I'm afraid I can't now give the page number, but I can give it next week. In the logic of scientific discovery, he says, it's an afterthought in a footnote, that of course what can be refuted, completely contrary to this, what can be refuted is not just a hypothesis, but a conjunction of hypotheses. He doesn't go into this, but he never discusses seriously the ceteris paribus clause, which is a sort of blanket in, you know, what is a ceteris paribus clause? It is nothing else but H1 and H2 and H3 and point. Now, he never discusses this problem, which of course is the crucial problem. I mean, anybody who knows read anything about methodology of economics, this is always discussed. But in physics, this is the same. After all, on planets, we can have magnetic fields acting. As I mentioned, when I drop a billiard ball, a metal billiard ball, then a magnetic field may lift it upstairs. I mean, that's a ceteris paribus clause. Now, but if we take now benevolently the specific hypothesis that all that we need is to put forward Newton's four laws of gravitation, let us put it, Newton's three laws of dynamics plus law of gravitation, plus, I don't know, 27 initial conditions, and plus 37 observational theories. Now, if I now derive from this an observational statement which is inconsistent of it, that something, now, what shall we do? Should we cross this out? Now you see, the interesting thing is that the Newtonian scientists, now let us imagine the negative case in which he doesn't find the disturbing planet, he doesn't find the cosmic dust, he doesn't find the magnetic field, and then for some reason, internal or external, the project is abandoned. By internal reason, I mean he can't think of anything more. And by external reason, I mean that he thinks of something more, but it is too expensive to carry out a new experiment. Now, what does then the Newtonian theorist do? Does he give up the idea that there still must be a disturbing planet? There must be still a cosmic dust, there must be still a magnetic field. Only, he says, I wish I could see what is still wrong with the whole thing. Namely, what additional elements does the ceteris paribus clause contain? He doesn't give it up, and in fact, in 20 years' time, something may come up, either experimentally or by imagination. So in fact, we see that even this conjunction will not be crossed out, only shelved. We say, well, we deal with this later. And what I claimed was that in each year of Newtonian theory, there are 37 such anomalies. Now, what in fact we are doing is here an ad hoc maneuver. Namely, we say that this state of affairs can be deduced from a disturbing planet, from a cosmic dust, from a magnetic field, plus something which we cannot specify. Now, that is clearly ad hoc, because this is untestable, something which we cannot specify. And what I claim, that history of science is full of this, but I shall later discuss, tenacity, and without this there wouldn't be scientific progress. Now, of course, there is a third interpretation of Popper's falsifiability criterion, namely to say that, well, we have to say right down in the annals of some periodical that this whole business is falsified full stop, and we are not allowed to say that something my auxiliary hypothesis might save it. Of course, it's too stupid to say, and of course Popper never said anything like this.
Well, you say there are things he doesn't account for. I'm not saying I quite agree with you, Robert. I mean, there are things which he doesn't account for. All the small point I was disagreeing with, which I still disagree with, is that his demarcation criterion doesn't actually render this pseudoscientific as presented in us.
Don't you agree that according to Popper, it is not a theory which is pseudo-scientific, but a scientific procedure, a sort of how do we treat the
situation?
Now that means that he has to say, and he lays great stress on it, you see, again, any demarcation criterion has at least two aspects. The third I can't go into it in this context. That's the problem of induction. One aspect is a code of intellectual honesty. Do confess that your theory at some stage went hopelessly wrong. Abandon it in public. Now, this never happens.
Well, look, what's the difference between abandoning and shelving?
I will tell you, because then you go on with the Newtonian theory, forget about this single application, or to quote him about, for instance, a psychoanalytic case. You say, well, this patient, well, something is wrong with him, I don't know what, but I go on with my psychoanalytic practice. But the whole message of Popperian philosophy is that at some stage it is dishonest not to give up a theory, whether in specific version or whether it's harmful.
In 62 years.
No, in 35. I don't want to insist on this weakness.
Okay, he lays down specific conditions for introducing auxiliary hypothesis, which that satisfies. I would call shelving it abandoned.
But look, now then I am asking one question. Since one of my theses, which I hope to develop today, will be that Popper is a step backwards from Duhem, 1905. Now, just try to think what Duhem would have said with this sort of thing. Duhem would have said, well, these things happen, but if the auxiliary hypotheses are very cumbersome, very complicated, then the time has come to replace it with something simple.
I disagree with that as
well. Well, you disagreed when you said that the Popper quotation, I read it out to you. Now, but look, after all, I mean, most LSE students obviously read something about Popper. Popper's core philosophy, according to his autobiography, which you find in Conjectures and Reputation, his whole autobiography says that he really became a full-blooded philosopher by being fascinated by the following problem. He had at the age of 16 and 17 endless discussion with Leninists and with psychoanalysts and Adlerians, I mean the psychologists with whom he was closely associated, and whatever he said, they had a way out. Therefore he decided, now I quote again Popper's words, that scientific theories, if they deserve the name scientific, should be at least semi-decidable, one-sidedly decidable. This is in his famous first publication, a letter in the periodical Erkenntnis, 1933. This is first publication, only two pages, and that is the message. Scientific theories must be at least one-sidedly decidable. They cannot be proved, but they have to be disproved. Now, this was what set him off on his philosophical career. Now, in this course, allegedly, Popper's three major contributions to philosophy are his falsifiability criterion. I claim that these are a step backward from Duhem. Two, his the solution to the problem of induction, where I think he is a step backward from Hume. I can't argue with this course, I argue this in my published writings. And the third is his literary masterpiece, The Open Society, by one of its, what is it called? Sorry, I don't like to plagiarize this joke. I like to priorities write joke stems 1958, Professor Morris Friedman. Now, so that's a literary masterpiece. I frankly, I'm not a political philosopher. I don't know what is right or wrong with it. I certainly think it's an absolutely marvelous piece, Open Society. So certainly two-thirds of his philosophical fame is based on misjudgment. So let us, perhaps we can come back to this next time. I shall try to, oh God.
Can we leave it at the, what you call shelving equals abandonment?
Pardon?
Can we leave it at the, what you call shelving?
No, I will tell you why. I'm terribly sorry. Here I have to. Let me say now this much. The dramatic difference between shelving and abandoning will be clear in, I hope, in about 10 minutes. Now, because I need to develop a little bit of more conceptual machinery to say what a dramatic abyss is between shelving and abandon. Now, it's simply the Popperian framework is too narrow to formulate the answer to this problem. Now, incidentally, according to Popper, and again, Alex, I think you will find it very difficult to refute this, the logic of scientific discovery says that that the rationality of the scientific enterprise depends, and he repeats this 12 times, so you obviously remember at least one place, depends on cutting the propositions into two, basic statements and theoretical statements, namely that we should have, statement, falsifiable statements and unfalsifiable statements. These are absolutely basic, because if all theories are unfalsifiable, for which actually he also uses the word metaphysical, if all statements are metaphysical, then Newton and Marx are on a par. You remember the table I drew up at the beginning, the Buddhist and the Vedic. Now, the whole enterprise of demarcation criteria hinges on whether we can have this dichotomy, whether we can have some criterion to decide about the two. Now, the Marxists can always say, well, we shelved the Hungarian Revolution, we shelved the invasion of Czechoslovakia, it will be explained later, it is only a matter of imagination, and of course finding the American agents who did this. Now, you see, Marxism and Freudism, once we take the shelving, abandoning equation, is exactly on a par, and therefore Popper's enterprise completely founders. Moreover, I pointed out, and this is a matter of historical fact and not of logic, that all theories are anomaly laden. That means there are always problems in any theory which have to be shelved. No, if all theories are born refuted, then it is quite clear that all theories are falsified at the very beginning. Now you see, all this dichotomy then falls down. Now I also pointed out that in order to maintain his philosophy, Popper forges history in a most ridiculous way. I can give examples, actually, if you have the conjectures and repetitions, I can show the examples, where he really seems to believe that we have a conjecture, and when it is put forward, it is unrefuted, then we have a refutation, then we have a new conjecture which is not yet known to be refuted at the time, and a new refutation, and so on. Now, in my, it's a matter of historical fact. When we put forward a conjecture, we already know the anomalies where it doesn't apply, right in the beginning. So, what is the refutation? It must be some curious anomaly. How do we decide what is a serious anomaly which is counted as refutation and what is not? Now, this question was first put to Popper by me. It is funny, but this is the case. And the word sort of spread around, and when he had this a television interview, which is now published in Brian McGee's book, what is it called? Modern British Philosophy or something. Now, Brian McGee asks him, tell me, if science grows through conjectures and refutations, why wasn't Newton's theory abandoned with Mercury's anomalous perihelion in 1820? And then Popper says, well, because Mercury's perihelion was not a serious anomaly. It's, in a letter to me, written at the same time, he explains that if an object would move around the sun in a square, that would be a serious anomaly. Now, it is quite clear, if you remember my elitist authoritarian position, which of course is completely abhorrent to Popper by instinct. Of course, then what is the demarcation between an unserious anomaly which one can shelve and a serious anomaly for which one has to give up the theory? Now this is a matter, obviously, for taste or for the scientist's authority. So demarcationism in Popper degenerates at his age of 70 into Polanyism, which he described in this very school for 25 years as obscurantism. Now he arrived to the very same obscurantism when his theory crumbled. Because, I would like to repeat this, because the demarcation between a serious refutation and a shelvable anomaly is a matter of judgment. Now, a matter of whose judgment? Scientists, Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party, whose judgment? The judgment of an elite. Now, incidentally, just to give one final example of Popper's complete confusion, and again, as I quoted Morris Friedman before, I don't want to steal the joke from my rather narrow-minded friend, Alan Musgrave, who saw the joke, but not its consequences. You see, Alan Musgrave prepared the subject index of conjectures and refutations. Now, if you look up in conjectures and refutations the subject index and look up Marxism, you will find the following entry. Marxism, comma, irrefutable, page 33, refuted, page 133. Now, of course, Marxism is bound to be irrefutable because Marxism is unscientific, that was his original axiom. But unfortunately, Marxism was refuted by the lack of absolute impoverishment by the revolution, the first revolution in the industrially least advanced country, and so on and so on. So it is refuted. So, well, you get both in Popper. Well, it is a bloody mess, and I frankly think it is a sociological mystery how it survived for so. Actually, by now, actually, Popper's immortality is completely secure and based on these idiotic results. If you look up, reviewing nowadays is in two stages. First, a book is reviewed in weeklies, like Listener, it's Economist, Nature, and these are, and then a man like Sir Karl Popper publishes a book like Objective Knowledge, he published recently, then editors rush to ask another knight to comment on it. So you see, the first reviews are written by a great man like Sir Peter Medawar or Sir Herman Bondi. Actually, two of the major reviews were written by them. Now you see, these people, since these weeklies must be up to date, have to write the reviews on the basis of having read the table of contents. Now, so you will see that both Medawar and Bondi say that this is a new great classic of the great man. The first two chapters, actually, I think, bear the signs of medical sanity. Now, this brings something to my mind. Now, and then comes the second stage of reviews. Then comes, and you see, they say that by now, say both Bondi and Medawar, nobody contests anymore Popper's results on induction and his criterion of falsifiability. So by the time the sort of professional philosophers of science all agree that that is past, in the weeklies, this is reasoning to immortality, and do believe me, in the history of philosophy, the weeklies will have their way. Now, see, now why? Because then 2 years later comes a second generation of reviews in learned journals. Now, since by now reviewing has no social standing, I mean, people, you see, the 50, I remember actually when I was young, I remember how, with what fascination I read Hewell's review of Herschel's book in 1833. And it was 40 pages, and it was a thorough review. And at that time, everybody thought very highly of reviewing. Nowadays, reviewing is done, I hope that none of you will take offense, by research students. And, I better not comment on those. Now, actually, since I said a statement which is, although true, about Sir Karl's senility, but I think is Michael Sander will testify true statements in English law can be libelous. Yeah. So I better add at least another piece of truth.
No, you're all right, it's not libelous.
Pardon?
If you're true, it's not libelous.
No? Oh God.
Very trouble is you have to be able to prove it.
Law is based, of course, on 16th century methodology. I don't want to defend my statement, but I am now embarrassed to have published Morris Friedman's libelous remark, it's open society, by one of its enemies. Now, this actually is a dramatic prediction, which was rather dramatically confirmed by fact. If you look at, this is a personal remark, but at least I hope it will amuse you, and then I shall get on to research programs. If you look up Conjectures and Refutations, third edition, paperback, and if you look at the name index, you will see Lakatos I, page 9. And if you look at page 9, it is preface to the third edition. Now, my name is not there. Now, the background of this is that he originally wrote in that preface that Lakatos' criticism of my falsifiability criterion and of my theory of induction arrived too late to be taken into account in this volume, but he then changed his mind and decided not to give publicity to this lousy criticism and cut it out. Now, that was in 1967 or something. In 1972, he published his book Objective Knowledge, and there, if you look at the name index, Lakatos again appears in the name index, page 38F, which means that in a lengthy way. Now, you don't find my name there again, but it says that my critics contended that, and then I'm afraid there is something which I definitely never said, but that is how Popper misunderstood it. But this, of course, has nothing to do with the world of ideas. But now, it is an interesting problem. I shall introduce now the problem of the concept of progressive and degenerating problem shifts. And then it will be an interesting sociological question, which is completely outside the realm of this intellectual course, namely whether the representatives of degenerating problem shifts can maintain or usually maintain standards of elementary personal honesty or not. Now, that's a very interesting question, and perhaps next year I shall go into it after my retirement, where I turn to sociology of science. Now, let me take stock now of the situation as it stands now. You remember that I introduced a trichotomy. You remember, here was epistemological anarchism. Any belief is just as good as any other belief. Science is just a matter of beliefs on a par with as under beliefs. And Feyerabend was the main contestant, the main advocate. Actually, I gave the reference that his famous paper Against Method, Minnesota Volume 4, funny enough, none of you complained that the library forgot to buy it. The second is elitism or authoritarianism is Jewish, primarily represented by Polanyi and Kuhn today. And this says that there is a demarcation criterion between science and non-science, but only great scientists can see it. Also, they can judge whether a scientific theory is better than another. Now, then I said that I don't like this because I'm a Democrat and I'm for statute law and case law having at least some balance, so I'm all for a demarcation criterion written out on the blackboard, so demarcationism. Now, and here I said that, inductivism, you remember, simplicism is here, falsificationism, a step back, is here. And then, now, I said that each of these determine a code of conduct of intellectual integrity. Namely, these people say that there is no such thing as intellectual integrity, do your own thing. These people, Polanyi says, do your master's thing. Kuhn says, do your master's thing or do your own thing as soon as you can convert to others, but you better don't do it before. And demarcationism, now each version has a different code of conduct. Inductivism says roughly, never utter anything which is unproven, codified it seems in the libel law. simplicism says that, or ensemble probabilism say never utter something without at least specifying what is the probability of each given the evidence. Unfortunately, this is always the rule. So that falls down. Now these two fall down, you remember, on logical grounds. Simplicism, give up a theory when it becomes too cumbersome and replace it with a simpler one. Now, I don't frankly remember how much in detail I showed, but it can be, we can do it, that the paradigm cases of this, namely that allegedly we abandoned Ptolemy because Copernicus was simpler is false, we abandoned Newton because Einstein is simpler is false, they are simply not simpler, and finally falsifications is that under certain well-defined conditions we have to give up our theories. Now, this code of honesty, it seems that if this is applied, then Marx and Newton fall together. Now, I also mentioned that all these three classes determine a certain historiographical outlook, and if they are false, they create historical myth. According to epistemological anarchism, actually this creates the least myth, because one can describe sort of everything as it happened, only that one doesn't attach any normative values to it. Elitism actually has some historical evidence. You remember those genealogical trees of great scientists and so on. But you see, here, demarcationism, this is the most influential historiographical view, namely, according to inductivists, all theories which were unproven theories are replaced by proven theories. Cumbersome theories by simple theories, and here, falsified theories by unfalsified theories. You know, this is the big miss of negative crucial experiments. I mean, it's a huge industry. If you look at history of science textbook, you get always big essays on some famous negative crucial experiments, how Michelson-Morley refuted the Isar theory, how Lavoisier refuted the phlogiston theory, and so on and so on. Now it turns out, if you look at it, that these all myths, because if you look at the periodicals, it seems that the refuted theory survived very lively for decades afterwards. That crucial experiment was invented at least 40 years later. So you see, this big historical mismaking is going on. Now, does this mean, when we come to this point, that we should sort of give up two sciences we are told, we are at the end of my last but one lecture, and we seem to be in a considerable chaos. Now, before I go now to my tentative solution, which actually is very much in this line, not completely, very much in this line, because I am sort of by birth and education a British pragmatist, I tend to say that although this should be the main line, we should have some compromise with these people, as I hope to explain next time. But let me just say that what struck me, that if I want to make out, you remember the goodies and baddies, if I want to make out the goodies goodies, I have to make out at least two things. First of all, I have to differ, say, let us take the frame of reference Popper. I have to differ him at least for two absolutely vital, points. I have to abandon refutation as something which causes us to abandon it. I mean, falsifications are somehow irrelevant. As I shall show you next time, the greatest victories of science were verifications, not falsifications. So we are back 40 years earlier, because 40 years earlier, most people agreed on this. Only how Popper fooled them, I don't know. So I go back to verification. Second, if we want to make out the goodies goodies, like for instance, if we want to make out Einstein is good, we have to explain, but no, or say Max Planck, one of the greatest physicists of our time, is good. Then we somehow have to explain why nobody believed them for at least 10 years, including, in Planck's case, himself. Planck had his great discovery in 1900, and from 1900 to 1908, he didn't do absolutely anything but try to disprove his own theory because he thought it was so idiotic. Now, in 1908, actually, you know, he invented the quantum theory. In 1908, he switched off quantum theory completely because he couldn't really take to his own theory, gave up the idea of repetition and just take his mind off it, actually joined Einstein's relativity program, which at that time had nothing to do with quantum theory. So he just changed the subject. He wanted to forget this. But it is quite clear that if I want to make the goodies goodies, tenacity, dogmatism, has to be somehow in some circumstances at least good. So I have to distinguish between good dogmatism, big tenacity, a good tenacity, from bad tenacity. You see? And forgetting about refutations, because all theories are born in a notion of anomalies, inconsistencies, I mean, that is nothing. And I quite agree with Popper. Of course, Popper always says, look, let us try to verify Newton's Galileo's theory of free fall by dropping this chalk and measuring the time which it takes to reach the tape. Now, if we measure it a million times, say with a dropping machine, and record it automatically while we are asleep, instead of only 1,000 times, certainly this doesn't add to the value of the theory. So, my problem is how to distinguish between good important verifications and unimportant verifications, but not like Popper between serious and unserious anomalies, so that's a great sign. Actually, he wrote it in a letter to me, I shall perhaps bring it next time. He says, if you understand anything about physics, I'm now quoting not Polanyi, but Popper, if you understand anything about physics, you see that this would be a serious application, but not the Mercury's Rosetta motion. Full stop. If you understand anything about physics. Now, that's, of course, Polanyi's position. Now, you see, I want to give criteria between good dogmatism and bad dogmatism, good verifications and bad verifications in such a way that it can be tested by the layman, because I have some respect for the layman. So that will be my last lecture. Thank you.